Hello and welcome. We've just discussed the statute of frauds and how many times a contract needs to be in writing in order to be legally compliant with New York state law. We've discussed the parole evidence rule, whereby because written contracts evidence the expressed intent of the parties, outside evidence, oral testimony, or what they call extrinsic evidence, which is outside written testimony, should not be brought in to contradict that contract. There are exceptions, and we went through those. But by and large, the statute of frauds says certain contracts must be in writing. Over and above that, any contract can be in writing, and by the way, should be in writing. But the parole evidence rule says when you put it in writing, you don't bring in outside evidence to contradict that writing. You look to that contract. You look to that written expression of the parties in order to see that contract. Now we're going to talk about what we call rules of construction and interpretation. Sometimes that written contract is not as clear as it needs to be. And what do you do in those circumstances, and how do those rules of construction and interpretation work? So let's go through those. First, some definitions. We'll go back to our definition of contract. It helps us when we focus on what does a contract mean and what are the parties trying to do, to remember what a contract actually is. It's an agreement between two or more parties creating obligations that are enforceable or otherwise recognizable by law. And what are those contractual elements? First and foremost, you have to have an agreement. Those parties have to come together and agree to do something. It's got to be between competent parties. They have to have capacity. They have to understand what they're agreeing to. It's got to be based on genuine assent. They have to understand that they're making a contract. They have to understand what those terms are, and they have to agree to it. It's got to be supported by consideration. It can't be a one-sided thing whereby both parties have to come in and give a promise for a promise. It's got to be for a lawful purpose subject matter. Can't be violative of public policy. Can't be illegal. You have to do it for something which is perfectly acceptable, and most things are, because we have freedom of contract. And lastly, it's got to be in legal form. If it is required under the statute of fraud, it's got to be in writing, and it's got to be signed by the party to be charged. Otherwise, it's got to meet whatever conformity that is required for those elements. What are the rules of construction and interpretation of a contract in general? Well, the process of interpretation, which is inferring from the facts, and construction, inferring as a matter of law, follows several rules and legal methods. These include the intention of the parties, the examination of the entire contract, the analysis of contradictory or ambiguous terms within the contract, a determination of implied terms, conduct and custom of the parties, and matter and avoidance of hardship, which is an equitable issue. What about disputes versus the law and disputes of fact? Construction is the implication of a term of a contract as a matter of law. It's not a factual issue, it's a legal issue. And where the parties did not actually deal with that particular issue in the contract, where there's no factual evidence to establish how they intended to deal with it, that's what construction does. Interpretation, on the other hand, determines the legal effect of the words in a contract. Interpretation identifies the meanings of the words. Now, we're going to get into each one of those in turn, but overall, remember that the construction and interpretation of the contract begins with the contract. First thing you have to look at is the intent of the parties, because that's what a contract's all about. Is what are the, in order to have an agreement, what did they intend to do that? Well, when people enter a contract, it's presumed that they intend their agreement to have some sort of effect, that it will strive to determine, the court will, that the intent of the parties is to give effect to that contract. And it needs to be enforced, that contract, pursuant to the terms of the contract. So whatever they are, the court's going to interpret the terms as, hey, this is what you wanted to do. This is what you agreed to. The intent is found from the words of the contract. And under the doctrine of freedom of contract, no particular form of words is required. It's what the parties want to put in that contract. Whatever words that manifest that intent that the two parties have is what they can use. But in the absence of proof that a word has a particular meaning or that it was employed by the parties with that meaning, the courts must give a common meaning to that particular word. As set forth above, the ordinary words are to be interpreted pursuant to the ordinary meaning of their meaning. So you're not going to find some obscure meaning of that unless the rest of the contract kind of defines that. You can incorporate by reference a term. So if you use a term which is a trade name, or you use a word which is best defined in law, and that you say we're going to use that term as it is defined in the general business law, for instance, you can incorporate by reference, and then the contract brings in that reference as a matter of law. In order to get the meaning of the contract, you have to look at the whole contract. This is called the four corners rule. And the provisions of the contract need to be construed as a whole, not as just taken as a part. It's got to be looked at the whole thing. And every word of the contract, therefore, is to be given effect if reasonably possible within the meaning of the whole document. And the plain language of the contract is viewed to solve disputes. And if it's defined someplace else in the document, then you go to that place. The court doesn't make a further analysis beyond that. The four corners of the contract are what is critical in examining the contract. So proper contractual interpretation first focuses on the normal accepted meaning of the words used by the parties within that contract. And it calls the four corners of the contract. That means you only look to that document. You don't look outside of it. And this is part of the parole evidence rule. It goes hand in hand. It's interlocked with that. They look at the plain meaning. Where the court has no evidence that the meaning is other than the plain meaning, they go by the plain meaning. And they go by that contract, and where the contract expresses the disputed term in clear and unambiguous language, then extrinsic evidence is rejected. Courts are very reticent to bring in parole evidence. Again, it's only got to be where you have a circumstance where either the contract is ambiguous, you don't understand, possibly understand whatsoever, you search the entire document, you can't figure out what that means. Absent that, absent the ambiguity, unless the contract was with fraud or duress or some kind of mistake, or there's evidence that a part of it was left out, which is a form of mistake, then they go by the four corners of the contract. What does that contract say? What's the ordinary meaning of the words? That's what they'll find. New York follows this rule. New York is known as what we call a textual jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals has explicitly held that the Four Corners approach should be followed in New York, and that an examination of the entire contract must be done to determine the meaning of the terms of a contract. And it says that extrinsic and parole evidence is not admissible to create an ambiguity in a written contract, which is complete and clear and unambiguous on its face. You don't raise ambiguity just because somebody claims it. The court has held, Court of Appeals has held under case law, when parties set down their agreement in a clear and complete document, that means there's not a part missing, that means there's no fraud, there's no duress, evidence outside the four corners of the document as to what was really intended, but unstated or misstated, is not admissible. You can't add to the writing. The writing is what it is. Under this New York State document, where the plain meaning is within the document, it is governing, and that document is what you follow. So you look to the whole contract, you look to the four corners, and that's what tells you what it is. Now, sometimes you do have contradictory and ambiguous terms. If a term is defined as one way in one section of the contract and another way in a different section, unless those sections are doing different things, then you have a problem. You still look to the four corners of the document first. You look to the plain meaning of those words. But where a provision is ambiguous, if it's if it's capable of more than one reasonable interpretation because of the way that it's drafted, a finding of ambiguity is justified only if the language of the contract cannot reasonably support what is being asserted. What constitutes an ambiguity is when the intent of the parties is uncertain and the contract is not capable of a reasonable interpretation. The background from which the contract and dispute arose under those circumstances can be brought in. But other than that, it can't be. When a contract is different formats, this becomes a problem too. To give you an example, if a contract is printed in a printed form and you have handwritten notes on it, those handwritten notes are taken as modifications in the final contract. So you follow that. Similarly, if numbers are written out as opposed to the number themselves, so instead of writing one, a single digit, you write O-N-E, the written term is viewed as more accurate than the single digits. It's basically saying this is what the parties meant as their intent, and that's the nature of the writing out. Now, realize when you have these interpretations, when you have an ambiguity or you have a conflict in the terms, it says this for one thing and that for something else the meaning of a term. The contract strictly construed against the party who drafted it. So if I'm saying, hey, listen, that's not what we meant, here's why, because it's defined one way over here and another way out of there. The party who drafted it is held to have made the mistake, not the party who's claiming it. What about implied terms where it's not really spelled out? In certain cases, a court will imply a term to cover a situation where the parties failed to provide a necessary term that's indispensable. What they'll often call it is material to the contract. The court can do that. It tries again to look to the four corners of the document to keep the intent of the parties as whole as it can. Construction and interpretation under New York State law is done with a razor blade, not with a machete. It is done as close to the original contract as you can contain. And they don't like to do it anyway. Only when they have to, the term is ambiguous, a reasonable person can't figure it out, or they left out a whole section, it's obvious that they made a mistake there. Those implied terms can then be brought in. Now recognize, as we talked from our last discussions, every contract is deemed to have been made in good faith with the implicit obligation of fair dealing. Any interpretation is made consistent with good faith, that party really intended to do that. And it's got to be in harmony with good faith and fair dealing. Indeed, the UCC has a direct requirement of that. And under common law in New York, you have that too. But recognize that overall, with rules of construction and interpretation, the courts look to the four corners of the document. They try to keep to the interpretation and intention of the parties as much as they can. Sometimes they have no choice. If somebody defines term one way in one section and one way in another section, and those two sections don't have a difference, you got a problem. Because of the fact that what did the parties intend? You need to know what the parties intended on it. And that way the contract then can be reformed to come up with the intent of the parties. But a construction interpretation, very lightly done. Now, sometimes when there's missing elements, you can go with the conduct of the parties and the custom of the parties. What has been these are two parties that have contracted many times in the past, and it's always been their conduct or their custom to do it this way. And in this contract, there's some kind of mistake where they're not doing it that way, or they left something out because they've always done it that way and they know they're going to do it that way again. That can be held. This isn't an issue where you're violating a section of the contract. Courts are very reluctant to overturn express provisions. This is when something's left out and there's a question as to how it's been done. And if it's always been done one way, then the courts are very, a manner where they'll try and keep it that way, because that's the way the parties have always done it, and you didn't express it in the contract this time. So conduct of the parties in the past, as well as their custom and their usage within a trade per se, that all plumbers always do put this in their contract, and you're going to see that in our case tonight with respect to a steel company, that all steel companies do their contracts this way, and that everybody understood it going in. Conduct and custom of the parties is something the parties understood going in. And that's one of the reasons why this is upheld by the courts. You have to understand, with all of these rules of construction and interpretation, the parties want to respect the freedom of contract of the parties. They want to be able to say, hey, listen, you can write your contracts any way you want, and we're going to uphold them the way you wrote them, not the way we wish you wrote them or the way we think you should have written them, but we're going to uphold it the way you wrote them. That's why New York State follows that four corners rule. It looks to the written document and says, that's what we're going to follow. Now, there is an equitable remedy, like there is so much in the law, And it says that we're always going to try and interpret a provision where it avoids a hardship, where it provides for fundamental fairness. So where you have a hardship in a contract because of changed circumstances or something like that, the courts try to interpret it in such a manner as somebody doesn't get wiped out. That being said, that's an equitable remedy. That goes beyond a legal issue. They, again, you have that fundamental duty of fair dealing and good faith in any contract. So they kind of fall on that for this hardship issue. There's also a French term called force majeure, by which, and this is frequently used in supply contracts. This came into play a little bit during the last few months with the COVID virus, whereby if you run out of supplies or things or can't, the contract, even though it calls for you to do this in this time frame, if you cannot comply with it, they'll, under an equity basis, the courts will say you did the best you could and we're not going to turn around and impose an unbelievable penalty on you for not doing that. Unless it can be clearly shown that you kind of anticipated that, and as a result of that, that was what was the intent of the parties completely under every circumstance, and they fully foresaw the issue that occurred, where with force majeure, what that does is basically says nobody could have foreseen this. Nobody saw the coronavirus coming, and as a result of that, some elements of the contracts couldn't comply in a timely basis for the amount of money that they were paid, and as a result of that, we're going to cut you a little slack. These are equitable remedies. They're rarely enforced, but they can be used. As a summary of this, the statute of frauds and the parole evidence rule seek to protect the concept of freedom of contract by maintaining the integrity of contracts and actually saying to the parties, we will uphold what you wrote. This reasoning is continued by contractual construction and interpretation as well. It's not just the statute of frauds and parole evidence rule, but all of these things are linked together. Interpretation and construction is based on that. And they will follow the four corners of the written document. If a party sits down with another party and they agree to something, the courts will follow what they agreed to. They're not going to make it up and say, you know, you should have agreed to this. They won't do that. They go off the reasonable person standard where there's an agreement between the parties, and they have to determine what the intent is and what the meaning of the words is. They'll go off of what a reasonable person would think their words mean. They go off the ordinary meaning of the word. And when it comes to trade words, they go off of what the trade meaning is of that word. They don't insert obscure meanings in it. It's the reasonable person standard throughout it. They look at that whole contract. They look at the entire contract, not just a one paragraph of it. They look at the entire contract within the four corners and try to adopt what the parties wrote. And they'll uphold that unless there is a serious, serious reason not to. New York State is a four corners contract state. That's what they do. And if you write a contract, that contract overall will be enforced because that is what you wrote, that's what you agreed to, and the courts find that if you do a written contract and you sign it, then that was what your intent was. Resolving conflicts, sometimes the courts have to resolve the contracts. There was something left out of the contract where there's a contradiction there. It's got to be a material matter. It's got to be a conflict that is directly that's harming one of the parties, and it's got to show that you didn't intend to do that. So as a result of that, it is interpreted as much as they can with the intent of the parties as that contract expresses it. And remember, when it is a question, it goes against the party who drafted the contract. We're now going to go on to our case, but remember, contractual construction and interpretation. Remember the statute of frauds. Certain contracts have to be in writing, and under the parole evidence rule, when they are in writing, you don't bring in extrinsic evidence in there. You don't bring in oral testimony. And with contract interpretation and construction, you try to keep to the written document, to that four corners, as much as possible. That is what is important there. And there are exceptions, like everything else. You've found a good lawyer when you ask him a question, or you ask her a question, she will tell you, it depends. Well, there's always exceptions. But at the end of the day, those are the general rules. With statute of frauds, those contracts have to be in writing. They have to be signed by the party to be charged. Parole evidence doesn't allow you to bring in outside evidence, either oral or extrinsic written testimony. And with respect to construction and with respect to contract interpretation, unless there is a mistake in the contract, unless it was showed that it was fraud or duress or mistake, or unless there's a conflict in the terms, or the terms cannot be understood by any reasonable person, then you follow the four corners of the document. You try to say that writing is the expression of the intent of the parties and follow it as closely as you can. We're now going to go on to our case, and we'll see you soon. Thanks so much.